Tell me what was their names, tell me what was their names. You have a friend on that good Ruth and James. What was their names, tell me what was their names. You have a friend on that good Reuben James.
This is, of course, the conundrum that FDR faced. He wanted to protect the United States mainland. Well, where are the boundaries that will protect us? But at one point during a press conference, he says, well, our boundaries run right up to the Rhineland, if that will protect American neutrality. This kind of aggressive executive action was not previously done outside of the Western Hemisphere by American presidents.
You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We're speaking this hour with Mark Wortman, who we had on the show earlier for a heist story about $3.2 million worth of art that was stolen in Mission Impossible fashion in London. Today we have him on the show to talk about a book that he wrote a few years back. The title of the book is 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, A Divided America in a World at War. Now, the reason why I started out with that song from Woody Guthrie, which some of you may know, it's the sinking of the Reuben James, is that that song was written about the first sinking of an American vessel in World War II, and it occurred a full month, 5 weeks, before we were in the war. America spent the better part of 3 years trying to figure out what to do about the war raging in Europe. And there were very bitter partisans on both sides. I had always been aware that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had worked very artfully and craftily to get us prepared to enter the war. I did not know the details. And in fact, the details are very kind of startling. And they'll provide a good fodder for some discussion about policy and democracy and accountability that have implications into the present. Without further ado, Mark, take us back to 19, I don't know, where do we start, 38?
We could actually even go back to December 1937, because if you think about the war as a global war, the Japanese were fighting the Chinese. One of our ships, you said that the Reuben James was the first
ship. Oh, there we go.
But
yep.
But we had a ship on the Yangtze River that was strafed and sunk by the Japanese in a sort of early prelude to Pearl Harbor itself.
The difference, though, was that that ship was not playing a combat role in a combat zone at the time it was strafed, right? Was it?
Well, it was protecting the removal of foreigners and U.S. diplomats from the combat zone.
Right.
And also protecting some of the, there were a lot of oilers, tankers carrying oil. So it did not have, by any means, a direct combat role any more than did the ships that were sitting in Pearl Harbor on that day in December 7th, 1941.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I see your point there. I want to get to an irony here that you just kind of brushed against. Oilers. There were lots of oilers carrying oil. Oil played a big role in our relationship with Japan.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oil was, in certain respects, a motivator globally of the war. You could think of that as well for what took place with Germany, as they sought to gain access to enough oil to continue their war. But it was particularly important for the Japanese, because the Japanese did not have oil, they did not have aviation fuel, and in fact depended for about 95% of their aviation fuel and something more than 85% of their oil needs from the United States. We were a big exporter, and Japan was engaged in this war, this very large war in China, and they were going through their reserves. And in the meantime, at a certain point in 1941, actually without FDR ordering it to take place, the State Department on its own initiative imposed an embargo of oil and aviation fuel shipments to Japan. And for the Japanese, this basically was an hourglass. It was a countdown clock to where they would no longer be able to maintain their military strength, because without aviation fuel, they couldn't fly their airplanes. Without oil, they couldn't sail those large carrier tasks.
Yeah, no kidding. So let me just, for the sake of clarity here, that plane that strafed and sunk that American ship in China, that was flying, almost certainly flying, American aviation fuel.
Yeah. And you could even fast forward to December 7th, 1941, and scrap metal from the United States was an important import for the Japanese that they used for their munitions. So you could say that the aviation fuel and the bombs and bullets that struck us on December 7th were supplied by the United States. It's an extraordinary irony.
Yeah, and it highlights the complexities of neutrality.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you could even go beyond that. The architect of the attack on Pearl Harbor, Admiral Yamamoto, had spent time at Harvard and several years as a naval attaché at the Japanese embassy in Washington. He was thoroughly familiar with the United States. So
Right. The
ironic connections are all over the place.
Yeah. Take us back to another incident in 1937 that was a few months earlier. I believe it was September of 1937. That was when Chamberlain had his famous meeting in Munich that then resulted in the takeover of Czechoslovakia. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was not amused at that either, was he?
Yeah, yeah. At that point, he thought this is the pathway to war. Hitler was not going to be appeased, and he began to think about ways in which the United States, which was bound by neutrality laws that he had signed, could act as a force that could prevent Hitler from going to war. He created the notion of a quarantine that we could, in some way, through our naval forces, through trade embargoes, begin to force the Nazis to basically think more than twice about attacking, certainly about attacking the United States. And he also began to set up neutrality zone along the American coast.
Which actually got increasingly ludicrous.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, the neutrality zone, you know, you start off with the 12-mile limit, and he then set up a 300-mile limit off the coast, which was a zone in which combatants could not enter. And then he moved it out step by step.
And for the record, this was hemispherical, so we were also including South America in this, right?
Yes. So he drew a line that he showed to his then Chief Admiral of the Navy, Stark, that ran down from Newfoundland in Canada all the way to the shoulder of Brazil in South America, and said, this is the neutrality zone. This is the zone of patrol. And American ships will patrol this zone, and combatants are not allowed to come into it. And if we see combatants in this zone, we will report in plain language on clear channels their presence. Now, it happens that the only power that this would benefit were the British, you know, who could then steam over and wait for it to cross out of the combat zone and sink it. The Germans had a very small navy. They had passenger ships and freighters.
So this was superficially neutral, but because the British had control of the surface oceans, the only people who benefited from it were the British.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But what if they reported the location of British shipping and the U-boats, you know, used it to locate them?
Well, at that point, the U-boats were sticking to the hunting grounds in the North Atlantic.
And eventually,
as you pointed out, Roosevelt kept marching this neutrality zone further and further to the east into the
far into the Atlantic. Eventually, by the summer of 1941, so we're talking 6 months prior to formal entry of the U.S. into the fight, the U.S. Navy had patrolled into Germany's declared combat zone, and the U.S. occupied Iceland. Took over.
So we started with Newfoundland, and then we went to Greenland, and by the summer of 41, we had taken in Iceland.
Yeah, absolutely. So America's neutrality zone was within a few hundred miles of Great Britain. You know, we're talking and far closer to Great Britain than it was to the United States.
And the Iceland move actually kind of, again, highlights the complexity of neutrality, because the Germans had repeatedly violated neutrality in order to seize Norway and, of course, several other countries on the European mainland. But the probability that they would seize Iceland and turn it into an aircraft carrier aimed at North America, I mean, how can you remain neutral with a country that is, you know, poised to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is, of course, the conundrum that FDR faced, that he wanted to protect the United States mainland. And you need to say, well, where are the boundaries that will protect us? You know, when we think now of the U.S. military, which is engaged in places around the world, well, we've effectively said our boundaries for protecting the United States extend essentially anywhere in the world. At that time, this notion was far from commonplace. But at one point during a press conference, he says, well, our boundaries run right up to the Rhineland, if that will protect American neutrality. This kind of aggressive executive action was not previously done outside of the Western Hemisphere by American presidents. So he was really taking unprecedented steps to protect what he saw as a potential aggressor against the United States mainland.
So while we're talking about unprecedented steps, let's talk about the British and their spy operations in the United States, and then let's talk about how the U.S. was collaborating with the British again long before we were actually at war, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The United States, in certain respects, became a front in the war. It was a non-combatant front in the war. The British sent a spy master, Sir William Stevenson, to established something called the British Security Coordination. It was set up in Rockefeller Center in Manhattan, and had a small plaque on the outside said something like passport control, British passport control.
Yeah, but this small plaque on the outside covered a whole floor of the skyscraper.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And that out of that skyscraper was a vast intelligence network and clandestine operations center covering the entire Western Hemisphere. Stevenson had spies working in South America. He had a propaganda operation going in the United States, and he had clandestine spy operations going on in the United States as well. He had people breaking into offices, tapping phones. There were, some of this has not been officially confirmed, there were apparently some assassinations as well that were designed basically to try to make the United States abandon its neutrality and to undermine Germany in the Western Hemisphere. One of the leading congressional opponents, Hamilton Fish, he was an isolationist who did not want the U.S. to get into the war. And they doctored photographs that they spread to the press to try to claim that he was closely allied with the German Bund, German fascist arm within the United States. They also were taking out advertisements at the 1940 Republican convention to undermine the candidates who were most identified with the isolationist wing of the Republican Party, people like Senator Taft.
This British operation was operating with the full knowledge and support and even coordination of the White House, right?
Yes. Roosevelt, at several stages, pushed to the limits of his constitutional authority and very possibly...
And beyond, as they say in Toy Story.
Yeah. He became aware of the British Security Coordination's operations. He was in direct communication with Winston Churchill at this point, and he told J. Edgar Hoover to do all he could to assist this spy operation. One of the undersecretaries in the State Department got word about what was going on with this and pushed to have the operation shut down. And was basically, he was shut down. And Hoover acted as a conduit to plausible deniability for the president between the British Security Coordination and Stevenson's operations and the White House. And in fact, at one point, you may remember from the book that there was a map, a doctored map that the British Security Coordination created, supposedly found on a German agent in South America. And that was somehow arrived at the FBI and then was brought to Roosevelt. And he, in a speech, said, I have a map right here in my hand showing the German plans for the takeover of South America. And the map showed five zones of occupied South America. Now, this thing was a complete fabrication.
He wouldn't show anyone the map either, right, FDR?
The press tried to get him to release the map itself, and he said, no, it's right here. I can't show you, but trust me. Germans, Hitler, have clear intentions on the Western Hemisphere. And he was using these tactics to try to drum up fear and basically drive the American public to get beyond their neutral status, isolationist status.
So tell me, there was an incident in Bolivia that actually is on the same lines, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was a coordinated effort between, so Nelson Rockefeller, who would later be the governor of New York State for several terms and a candidate for president, he was the head of an agency with some long acronym, a government agency that he set up with the specific purposes of having influences in South America and Latin America and Mexico. And he coordinated directly with the British Security Coordination, located in the Rockefeller Center.
Coincidentally, yes.
Together, they pushed the Bolivians to believe that a Nazi-fomented putsch coup was about to take place there. And the Bolivian government took all the government officials who were believed aligned with Nazi Germany, and many of the leading business figures who were involved in trade with Nazi Germany, and imprisoned and killed about 150 of them.
Whoa! I didn't even catch that there were actually executions associated with this.
Yeah,
and it was a complete fabrication.
It wasn't necessarily a fabrication in the sense – it was a fabrication that there was going to be a coup, but that there was extensive trade going on with Nazi Germany. That's certainly true, and that was true throughout South America.
Yeah.
Nazi Germany was dependent on – to get bauxite and many rare earth metals that were important in munitions and other equipment, military equipment. They were dependent on that from South America, as well as rubber and oil that was coming from there. So
But by the time the war actually got rolling, the British could shut that down just with their navy, couldn't they?
But at a tremendous price. you know, as things expanded, as the war got underway, essentially from day one, the German submarines were attacking British shipping and British warships. You know, the British paid a horrible, horrible price, both the Royal Navy, but also civilian shipping. So, shutting down that trade was not a simple matter, and in fact, FDR played a big role in that because of this neutrality zone that he set up. Many German ships that were in United States ports or sailing up the coast and being announced could not get out past that neutrality zone.
So they just went to port and just hung there through the war, mostly.
They just went to port and hung there until the U.S. finally took those interned ships and converted them to United States ships.
So, hey, I want you to tell me the story of the sinking of the German liner Columbus.
Yeah. Well, this is the neutrality zone in action. A German liner, considered one of the most luxurious liners of the day, a passenger ship, had gone to the United States Caribbean, to the Caribbean, and then was spotted there, sailed through the Caribbean, managed to elude detection without passengers. It had offloaded its passengers, I believe, in Cuba, and then came into port in the United States. And they basically ran dark up through the U.S. Neutrality zone until they were right off Cape Hatteras. They had blacked out the ship. They had a skeleton crew. And then they decided they were going to make a dash for it. They headed out toward the open waters off from about Cape Hatteras. And as they went out, they were picked up by U.S. Navy vessels, who basically announced the position of the ship as they were going out. And they kept announcing it, and they kept announcing it until British ships appeared on the horizon, and then the U.S. Navy dropped back. The British ships fired a broadside across the bow, and the German captain decided that he had no choice. He scuttled the ship. And there were photographs on the front page of the New York Times about the sinking of the ship, and there was absolutely no mention of the U.S. Navy's role in this.
They directly lied. They didn't just not mention it. They also said that the U.S. Navy stumbled on the scene, like in the aftermath of the conflict.
Yeah. So this, you know, the U.S. is what Roosevelt called unneutral acts that were started taking place from the very first days of the war. You know, we've barely scratched the surface there. When we think about the Bismarck and the sinking of the Bismarck, you know, you didn't mention
Right. I forgot that. Yeah. And that was again, complete news to me. Tell us where you're going there.
Yeah. So as part of Lend-Lease, the United States sent Catalina seaplanes as patrol planes to the British for the Royal Navy to patrol, to add to their coastal patrols.
Okay, I want to take a step back, because if we're going to talk about Lend-Lease, we should set the stage for it.
Okay, sure. So Lend-Lease was the an act essentially designed to give him the power to transfer American our relatively small supply of aircraft, tanks, trucks, ships, and guns, artillery to those we considered in need in defense of the United States.
Yeah, this gets, I mean, you talk about the complexities and neutrality. The reason why they had to go to these convolutions was that a true neutral nation could sell weapons to anybody as long as they did it on a cash basis. Mm-hmm. But once you start doing it on credit, then you start getting into, are you a neutral or are you an ally? And so we came up with this really convoluted game, you know, shell game almost to explain why we weren't violating neutrality, but, you know, we really were.
Yeah. Oh, it reached the point where airplanes that were manufactured in the United States couldn't, because we could not ship them to under American with American pilots, American truck ships, American trains, they literally had to be flown to the Canadian border or trained up to the Canadian border, and then hauled by on wagons across the border into Canada to be shipped the rest of the way to Britain. They went to that point to maintain this.
But what a ridiculous facade, because Canada itself was a belligerent.
Well, that, of course, was why we could not ship directly into Canada. We had to they had to come across and drag them over the border.
You mean by horse and wagon?
By horse and wagon or by truck. But yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
It could not be shipped. It could not be on trucks.
Now, none of this was actually convincing Berlin that we were actually neutral. You are listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We are speaking with Mark Wortman, the author of 1941, The Shadow War. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll explore a little further into the strange contortions that were necessary to maintain our alleged neutrality during the years running up to Pearl Harbor and our official entrance into World War II. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Eric Schultzke. We're speaking this hour with Mark Wortman, the author of 1941, Fighting the Shadow War. And we left it off at the break with a conversation about the Lend-Lease Act and how some of our planes and ships ended up getting involved in conflicts in weird ways where we would pretend that we were neutral when, in fact, both our men and our equipment was being used by the British. And it wasn't fooling anyone, least of all the Germans. But the Germans didn't want to fire the first shot. Yeah, I want you to finish the story of the Bismarck, and then I want to talk a little bit more about how Berlin was reacting to all this.
So those Catalina PBY patrol planes, once they got into Canada, they got flown in hops across to Great Britain for use on these patrols. Well, they sent American trainers, American military trainers, American Navy flyers over to train the British on how to fly these airplanes. Frankly, if you've flown one, 2 or 4 engine prop plane, seaplane, it takes you an hour or two of instruction, and then you can fly it. Well, Roosevelt told the Navy to send these flyers over for them to be trained in flying military patrols. So they stayed on for months there, and they ended up being relief pilots for the British, for the Royal Navy flyers. So it happened that when the Bismarck broke out from the British blockade through the North Sea, you know, the Bismarck was considered the unsinkable, unstoppable ship. Armor plated to a degree never before seen, powerful with guns that could fire far over the horizon,
incredibly fast.
And this ship sailed out from the North Sea through the Irish Sea and into the North Atlantic, and then engaged with the British and managed to escape from the British You know, Churchill famously said, "Sink the Bismarck." The Bismarck had sunk one of the Royal Navy's most advanced warships with the loss of all hands. And it was a terrible blow to the Royal Navy's prestige. And Churchill devoted everything he had to hunt the Bismarck and to sink it. Now, the Bismarck was hit, but it still managed to elude its pursuers and actually came within the United States combat zone, or rather neutrality zone. But then it sailed back north without having been found. And it was one of those American Lend-Lease PBY seaplanes flown by an American pilot that spotted the Bismarck. It was almost shot out of the sky by the Bismarck, but it managed to avoid being shot. So you already have, here you have an American pilot flying an American-made aircraft on behalf of the Royal Navy, and it's almost shot down by the Bismarck. But they spotted the Bismarck. They brought in that enabled the British forces to come sailing in, and that led to the final kill of the Bismarck.
So once again, our people are pretending to be neutral, but very pointedly getting themselves into shooting situations.
And the pilot of that American-made Catalina there was told, when he received a medal for his service there, he was told, "You cannot talk about this with anybody."
Right. Okay, now, the reason we had to maintain this facade of neutrality was because, as I didn't pick up anything in your book that suggests otherwise, 80% of the American public up until the final weeks still did not want to get in a shooting war with Germany.
Yeah. If you took a poll of Americans today and said, you know, does the sun rise in the east? You wouldn't get 85% of Americans to agree to that.
Mm-hmm.
But 85% of Americans agreed, we do not want to get into the war with Great Britain, even at the risk, rather get into the war with Germany, even at the risk of Great Britain losing.
Yeah.
And there was a very real possibility that Great Britain was going to lose.
Possibility. It was a near certainty.
It was certainly in the eyes of many people, importantly among them, Ambassador Joseph Kennedy, and almost certainty, and many people in the America First movement, which we haven't talked about, but which was the major campaign to keep the U.S. isolationist and out of the war, that many people in that movement believed the more we supply the British with arms, the more we're providing them arms that will be eventually taken by the Nazis and turned against us.
Right. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the shaping of public opinion, and you'd mentioned the American First Movement, but let's first go back to, so what was it, be September of 1939? Is that when the Germans invaded Poland?
Yes. So September 1st. So
and we had with that invasion, as observers, were two American quote unquote journalists. One of them was a journalist with CBS, and the other was kind of an odd duck.
Yeah. So you're speaking of Philip Johnson. Now, Philip Johnson is very well known today as a renowned modernist architect. Philip Johnson was, during his lifetime, perhaps the most influential architect in the world. But in the decade prior to World War II, he was already a renowned tastemaker. He had helped to found the Museum of Modern Art in New York City and created the first design and department at a museum in the United States. So he had a lot of cachet. But then he got swept up by his admiration for the Nazis and for Hitler. He attended Nuremberg rallies, and spent quite a bit of time in Germany, and believed that fascism was going to be the wave of the future, as did many other Americans.
Yeah, it's funny you use that phrase, the wave of the future, because that was part of the title of Anne Morrow Lindbergh's book that also was predicting the same thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There, we'll have to talk about Charles Lindbergh, but Anne Morrow Lindbergh wrote a bestseller in which she basically said that Hitler and the Nazis were and fascism were simply scum on or froth on the wave of the future as we move towards a new mechanistic industrial world.
And what she's saying basically, as I understand it, is that there, it has some rough edges that will have to be chipped off, but that the essence of it is democracy is not the future.
We're switching gears here, but she certainly sided with her husband, Charles Lindbergh, the famous transatlantic solo pilot, in his reverence, you know, because it really did amount to reverence for what Nazi Germany had done in creating what he saw as the most advanced aerospace industry and air force in the world, and one which he considered undefeatable. He thought that it was quite inevitable that Nazi Germany would overrun all of Europe and the Soviet Union, because he believed that their air force could not be stopped. He wanted the United States to build its ramparts high, to pull back behind its Atlantic wall, and to prepare itself just to defend itself and to leave Europe to settle its ages-old battles.
Yeah, but there's more to than just – I mean, there's two different streaks. One is isolationist and the other is sympathetic. And with both Lindbergh and with Johnson, there was sympathy, prudence. You could argue prudential. Like, there's another character we haven't mentioned, Teddy Roosevelt Jr., who I think is a prudential isolationist, right?
Yeah. The isolationist movement in the United States runs the gamut from socialists like Norman Thomas to right-wing anti-Semites like Henry Ford, from avowed fascists like Philip Johnson, who aligned himself with Father Charles Coughlin, a Roman Catholic priest of the airwaves, one very popular figure in that period.
Very funny alignments of some of these personalities, because here you have a prominent Catholic cleric who is basically touting the line of the KKK. Which they don't like Catholics either.
Yeah. It's, you know, there were many strange bedfellows. You'd get these people on stage together, and you'd say, how could they possibly be on stage together?
Yeah, and then there'd be moments like with Teddy Roosevelt Jr. where you go, like, what am I doing with these people?
Yeah, here Teddy Roosevelt Jr., who's one of the a leading figure in ecumenical councils. Teddy Roosevelt Jr. had fought in World War I, had been badly injured. His father was a former president of the United States who was urging the U.S. not to be neutral in World War I because he considered it a crime that Germany was conquering these small nations. Well, here we have a repetition of that in World War II, and his son, Teddy Roosevelt Jr., was campaigning for neutrality and was part of the America First movement.
Okay, so let me just like say a word on behalf of Teddy Roosevelt Jr.
He was such a hero.
Because
please go ahead.
Okay, didn't he lose a son in World War I? Quentin?
That was actually Teddy Roosevelt.
It's his brother.
It was his brother.
Teddy Roosevelt Jr. lost a brother. His name was Quentin.
Right. He was shot down and killed.
Yeah. But what my point in this context is that a reasonable person who is not sympathetic to Hitler in 1938, 39, 40 could have said this is not our war and still not have been a sympathizer.
Absolutely. absolutely. You're absolutely right. Americans recalled very well what took place in World War I, the slaughter of an entire generation of young men in Europe. And the expectation was that World War II would be World War I on steroids.
Right.
It would be and would result in essentially the destruction of civilization. You know, you can completely understand the mindset of people in the United States who said, why in the world, when we already came in World War I, saved France, and now here old Europe is back at it again.
Right.
Why should we send Americans
why,
to die?
Why should we be fighting to protect the British Empire?
Okay. So you're right there with the arguments that isolationists and neutralists were using. But of course, Roosevelt then has to muster the argument that says that the world has changed. The airplane, the advance in warships has changed the world so that an ocean that once might have been a moat that protected the United States from wars overseas could no longer do that. You know, if you're somebody in Indiana or Illinois, Michigan, places that were the hotbeds of neutral sentiments, you sit there and say, well, you know, this is awfully far away. Why in the world would I send my son, my husband, my father over there to risk being slaughtered in what was assumed was going to end up being another trench war, except with far more powerful weapons? And Roosevelt had to convince the American people that this war was a direct threat to them.
Yeah. And on the merits, I have to say, I mean, you know, we've talked about some counterfactuals, but if you just take as a counterfactual, Germany wins on the continent, mm-hmm. then Wernher von Braun is now building ballistic missiles for the Germans. And mm-hmm. and meanwhile, they are finishing their Manhattan Project, and yeah. and everything looks very different.
As Roosevelt said, you know, we cannot live isolated as the last democracy in the world. It quite simply cannot endure. You know, he had the uphill battle to convince the American people of to make the level of sacrifice that
yeah.
What would have to be a true global war would take. And you note, the U.S. did not declare war on Germany. It was Germany that declared war on the United States.
And that was what FDR was waiting and waiting and waiting for.
Yeah.
He spent 2 and almost 3 years hoping that Germany would fire the first shot. And Hitler spent all that time holding his guys back and saying, no, we cannot fire that shot.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was this very strange, again, ironic dance that was taking place in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, where you have American naval vessels supposedly within the so-called neutrality zone that extends almost to Great Britain, that are out there declaring the presence of German U-boats so that the British can come and attack the U-boat. Hitler has told his forces, don't shoot at the American ships. Well, the U.S. ships were also, because of, the U.S. had traded destroyers to the British for some bases early on, when the British were particularly desperate to get a hold of more destroyers to protect their convoys.
Yes, these shell games.
Yeah, and these destroyers were running without illumination of the U.S. flag. They were running with silhouettes that could not be distinguished from Royal Navy destroyers. And so the sailors aboard these ships understood that they were effectively decoys being put out to draw German fire. And, of course, eventually, inevitably, shots were fired.
Yeah.
And you started the program with, the story of the Reuben James, or the song about Woody Guthrie's great song about the Reuben James, and two other ships that were.
Yeah, this is probably a good place for us to wrap up. We've got three in a row. There's like bam, 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 the Greer, the Kearney, and the James. I want you to tell us how it was almost like, bronze, silver, gold.
Yeah. And you could even go back to the previous spring when there was a U.S. ship that believed it may have been under attack.
Oh, right.
There were three ships that were attacked, one with a miss, one with a direct hit that resulted in about 15 U.S. deaths, and then finally the Reuben James, which was sunk. And at each stage, Roosevelt was pushing the American people to see this as a direct attack on American neutral ships and attacked by the Germans. But of course, this was part of FDR's effort to draw out the Germans and to draw out American opinion. And this was this extraordinary process that was going on right up until December 7th, 1941, when all of those ruses and facades, all of those sort of unneutral acts, all of those deceptions, we've barely spoken about the things that had happened with China and the sending of the American volunteer
right.
that was
recruited. Yeah, there's so much that was going on.
Yeah. And the Japanese and their need for oil that was now embargoed. And so you had this hourglass that said, we either attack the United States now and hope to drive them back and keep them out of the war, or we'll never have the chance to do it again.
Yeah.
All of these elements coming together that finally resulted in everything like a puzzle that's been shaken out and turned upside down, and then suddenly all the pieces come back into place and you see the picture and you say, yes, we have a war here, and the U.S. has a role in this good war, and this is going to be the greatest generation. Prior to becoming the greatest generation fighting the good war, it was the United States in a war with itself.
Yeah,
in a secret war, a shadow war.
I picture it in Japan. I picture it as we talk through the whole thing. I picture it kind of like a birth, and we spent a very, very long time in labor.
That's a good analogy. It is. It's except that it's a birth that a lot of the mothers of America did not want.
Well, and with good reason. I mean, it's one thing for us to glibly say it was the good war, but there was a lot of sacrifice and, a lot of tragedy between there,
Yeah.
It's easy for us to look back. We've been speaking with Mart Wortmann, who is a popular historian, journalist, and author. His articles have appeared in Vanity Fair, Smithsonian, and Time magazine. We've been talking about his book, 1941, Fighting the Shadow War, A Divided America in a World at War. His next project, which is going to be coming out in January, is a biography of the father of the American nuclear navy, Hyman Rickover. Mark, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Eric. I've really enjoyed it. You might tell people if they'd like to learn more, they can go to my website, markwortmannbooks.com.
Okay. Thank you.
The Shadow War ended with Pearl Harbor, but then it was payback time. We're going to tell that story next on Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. One of the first moves the U.S. made after Pearl Harbor was a raid on Tokyo, and it was more symbolic than damaging, but it had tremendous impact on both Japanese and American morale. Here's part of a conversation about this event. Our guest was James M. Scott, author of Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor.
This operation required incredible stuff from the Army, but it also required the Navy to take them all the way over there. Task force of 16 ships and 10,000 sailors. So to bring together two service branches, to come up with the technology needed to be able to retrofit these bombers and to be able to train these men, all of this took place in just 16 weeks. which is really incredible when you think about timing and stuff to be able to put all this together. So then they had 5,200 miles across the Pacific. And the mission, of course, is predicated on the fact that the Japanese do not discover them before they get within 400 to 600 miles of Tokyo. That was the distance that Doolittle had calculated that they could safely take off, bomb Japan, and still have the fuel to make it to China. As they're closing in 2 weeks later on the Japanese coast, they run into a fleet of picket boats. And this was Japan's sort of early warning system. They didn't believe in radar like we did. So they stationed picket boats anywhere from a few hundred miles to 1,000 miles at sea. And the idea being that these boats would spot any inbound American task force. And, of course, that's precisely what happens. So Doolittle and his men are spotted when they're more than 800 miles from Japan. And at that distance, they're not going to have the fuel to be able to bomb Tokyo and make it all the way to China. So that morning of April 18th, Doolittle faces this incredible question, which is all this training, all this money spent bringing 10,000 sailors, all these warships here, do we just give up and go back, or do we just get in our planes and take off and hope for the best? And that's, I think, one of those pivotal moments of World War II, really, is when Doolittle climbs inside that bomber that morning of April 18th, and just 467 feet separate him from the cold Pacific waters, and he throttles up those engines, and he takes off. And then one after the other planes follow behind him, all inbound for Japan, Nagoya, and other key industrial cities there. So it's really just one of those moments of pure heroism and courage right there.
And it really was his decision. He gave the green light to go ahead.
Yeah, he did. And Doolittle would later say, you know, there wasn't a decision to be made. We just had to do it. But it really is, I mean, taking off at that distance. I mean, Doolittle had planned to take off at 400 miles. He'd set 650 miles as the outside maximum. And here he is over 800 miles. I mean, really taking off at that point, it's a suicide mission. And he was too modest to ever say that, but anybody else looking at that would recognize it for what it was. And it about turned out to be the case, as the planes, many of them did run out of fuel, in fact, as they were closing in on China.
James M. Scott is author of Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. Going to talk about wild donkeys on Friday. Wild donkeys dig wells in the desert. Yes, they do indeed. And when they dig a well, who gets to drink from it? Well, just about anybody, it turns out. From rodents to bears to a guest who's going to join with us on Friday on the show. Tomorrow we are preempted by BYU Sports, so join with us again Friday. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.